Hello there, folks, and thank you for tuning in. This is Peter Broderick here. Got a very special conversation with the one and only Sam Amidon for you, where we dive into the nature of folk music. Please accept my apologies for any sound issues at the moment. I think it's all listenable, but I'm just new to all this recording interviews, and hopefully that'll all get better over time. But for now, bear with me, and I hope you enjoy this one.
What is a song?
Where do songs come from? What is the life of a song?
How much can a song morph and change before it becomes something else entirely?
What is the essence of one song?
Sam, there you are. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very happy to be here.
I've got some cool effects set up if you want to hear. Check this out. Can you hear that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Woo!
Yeah, that's right. We're gonna
the Galway party has commenced.
Yes. Well, hey, I'm going to... There's three introductory questions that I intend to ask all the guests who do this. So those are...
Great.
How many years have you been on this earth? Where in the world are you now? And can you please tell me about the last meal that you ate?
I've been on the earth since June 3rd, 1981, which in a couple of months will be 40 years.
Wow. Thank you. Big one coming up.
Coming very soon. And I am sitting in my little office in Dartmouth Park / Tufnell Park / North London, England. Mm-hmm. And I have my Don Winslow Power of the Dog multi-volume Mexican drug cartel crime saga next to me.
Great.
And I... last ate a delicious croissant and orange juice this morning.
French, very European style breakfast there.
You know, yeah, like absolutely. It. Dartmouth nice. Park style.
All right. Nice. Well, is it okay for you if I just kind of give a little introduction as to how I first discovered you and why I want to talk to you about this one song thing?
Yes.
So I may have told you this story already, but it was back when, is it 2007 or 2008 when your record All Is Well came out? Was that 2008?
Yes, probably, I think 2008, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, 2008.
So, you know, I kind of heard that. That made a bit of a splash at the time. It was going around all the music blogs and stuff. And yeah, it really intrigued me and I ended up loving the album so much that I bought like 5 copies of it to give to a bunch of friends and family. Weirdly enough, I don't seem to have a copy with me anymore because I've moved so many times that like, you know, there's different record collections of mine all over the world, but
you gave it around.
But yeah, it was one of these, there've been 2 or 3 albums like that, where I just, it just resonated so strongly that I thought I need to share this with, you know, the people close to me.
Beautiful.
So yeah, there was that. And then, you know, I think the first time I saw you in person was at South by Southwest in 2009. I have a distinct memory of a, you know, at South by Southwest, there's all these kind of like mini shows in people's lawns and, you know, this one was in a parking lot and it was billed as a pancakes party.
I remember that.
You were playing some tunes on the banjo in the middle of a parking lot while the rest of us were eating slightly trashy pancakes. But yeah, it was a fantastic experience. And then,
and I think that was with Stars Like Fleas and with you playing solo later on.
I played solo later on inside a shed of some kind.
Yes. A little that was a beautiful morning.
Yeah. Yeah, it was beautiful. And I've kind of, you know, followed what you do ever since then. And when I first heard that album, you know, I was very intrigued by the fact that these are traditional songs that you have kind of very much made your own. And that's one of the things I want to try to explore in this little series is like, what is the essence of a song and how much can happen to it and have it still be the same song? And I think the folk music tradition is super interesting in that way.
Yes.
In that, you know, it's almost like, you know, have you ever done that game where you stand in a circle and you whisper something into someone's ear and they whisper it to the next person, and by the time it gets back to you, it's something Absolutely. Different entirely. And I feel like folk music is very much like that. And in a way, I feel like it's almost truer to how real life is, because, you know, like we in pop music, we have this, you know, this sort of definitive version of a song where like, this is the one right. We finessed it in the studio and this is it. This is the track, and people go and cover it and they try and learn it note for note and mimic this thing to make the song. But, you know, life isn't really like that. You know, things happen, they get passed around. It's very messy. And so, I feel like folk music is perhaps a bit more true to just the reality, the nature of things in that way. And then when I saw you play at that pancakes party, I saw you doing things in songs where, like, you know, there's this song, you're going to know this very well, where you're kind of playing on the banjo, doing the song, and then it says, what do you say, banjo? And you would, you know, play on the banjo. And, you know, and at some point you say, what do you say, push-ups? And then you'd get down on the floor and start doing some push-ups. And, you know, so again, but you're still playing the song, you know,
form.
Yeah. So I love that about what you do is you take the song form and stretch it out and play with it. And I feel like in a way your work does inquire as to what a song is. What is the song and where can we go with it? And the song I wanted to talk about today was Wedding Dress. And, you know, you've done so much work since then, and I hope it's not annoying for you to sort of, you know, have someone hone in on something that's from a long time ago. But the reason I wanted to ask you about that song is have you ever heard of a guy called Bob Gibson?
No.
Okay, great. So Bob Gibson, I discovered Bob Gibson through a strange rabbit hole when I was doing some research on Shel Silverstein. You know who Shel Silverstein is?
Yes.
The American comic and poet, songwriter as well. You know, he wrote a lot Absolutely. Of great songs, like a Boy Named Sue that Johnny Cash made famous.
And, right, yes.
So I kind of got obsessed with Shel Silverstein in the last few years, and I was doing all this research, and I found there was one guy he collaborated with a lot in his songwriting practice, And the guy who kind of got him into songwriting was a guy named Bob Gibson. And Bob Gibson kind of started off as a folk musician, got inspired by Pete Seeger and picked up a banjo, started traveling around, you know, America and the Caribbean and stuff during the 50s and learning songs. And he was kind of part of this first wave of people who took folk music and brought it onto a stage. You know, right. Before it was just like, these are just songs
social.
Of people. It's a social thing. But all of a sudden people are like, hey, I can, you know, there's these coffee shops popping up and saying, hey, play in the corner. And, you know, I think he had a lot of scenarios where he was at weird dinner parties and stuff, playing music in the corner as this Great. Sort of live music thing develops, you know? So this is Bob Gibson's first record here from 1956.
Cool.
It's called Offbeat Folk Songs. I think you would really
Bob Gibson and his banjo.
Bob Gibson and his banjo, yeah.
Great.
And,
I
think you would love this record. And I was listening to it when I first got it. I put, you know, side A goes and side B comes on. And the first song, I'm like, hey, I recognize this song. And I recognize some of the lyrics from Wedding Dress, which,
cool. You know,
Wedding Dress, I only knew your version of it previously. But I go and look at the back side, and the song is listed under the title Lula Gal.
Mm.
And so it just got me thinking, like, just about that thing I was just saying, how folk music gets passed around and it morphs and changes. And, you know, where is the song in there? And is there even a song, you know, like at some point, maybe it changes so much that it becomes something else entirely. So I actually made a rip of this tune from my turntable, and I thought maybe I could show it to you and
let's see what
you might have to say about that.
No doubt.
One sec here. Let me do a little screen share. Bob Gibson. Here, check this out.
Oh, Malulu gal, Malulu, I guess you better be making your wedding dress. Wedding dress, wedding dress, better be making your wedding dress. It's already made, it's trimmed in green. Prettiest thing you ever seen, ever seen, ever seen. Prettiest thing you ever seen. Well, it's already made, it's trimmed in brown. Trimmed all around with a golden crown. Golden crown, golden crown. Trimmed all around with a golden crown. Well, it's already made, it's trimmed in white. Gonna get married next Sunday night. Sunday night, Sunday night. Gonna get married next Sunday night. She wouldn't say yes, she wouldn't say no. All she'd do was sit and sew, sit and sew, sit and sew. All she'd do was sit and sew. Oh, Malulu gal, Malulu, I guess you better be making your wedding dress. Wedding dress, wedding dress. You better be making your wedding dress.
Wow, so cool. Nice banjo playing, too.
Oh, it's great. His banjo playing's awesome. There's a couple pieces on that album that are just solo banjo as well.
Cool.
You would love it, I think. I actually meant to... I just went on a long rant there. I think I'm new to this. I was a little nervous. But what I intended to do was ask you your story of the song, where you heard it, you know.
We can go in any order. There's no rules. It's a podcast. Yeah. That's so cool. No, it's beautiful. I prefer having the introduction first for where your mind has led you to this
right,
moment.
Right.
It's great. So I, one of the things about the, especially on in those first couple albums of the reworked folk songs that I made, is that I'm sort of both an outsider and an insider to the folk music thing, because of course from outside folk music, it's all folk music, but obviously within folk music, there's these really, you know, traditional Irish music, or, you know, Appalachian songs, or Georgia Sea Islands, or Texas, or, you know, all these places are very different, and yet people traveled from one to the other. So there's little links between them all. Right. And so for me as a kid, my parents loved all different kinds of folk music, including a lot of the Appalachian folk songs, and they sang them. But the thing that I really got into myself was Irish fiddle tunes.
Right.
And from the so as a 13, from about age 13 to 16 or something, which was really a critical time for me as a fiddle player, I was just profoundly obsessed with the traditional Irish fiddle style, and everything for me was through fiddling at that time. And the singing was like this thing I would do with my parents because that's what they did. And I wasn't really into singing or into listening to music with singing on it.
Right.
And even more specifically than that, the Irish fiddle style is so different from the American Appalachian fiddle style.
Yeah.
Again, there's a link. Irish people came to America, English people, you know, yeah. but it's a very different style, and it has more ornate, as you know, many of this, you know, a lot of this, but has a more ornate ornamentation, this kind of triplets and rolls on the fingers, and it's a different rhythmic feel, and harmonically it's very different. The Irish fiddle tunes are very harmonically ambiguous and have a lot of open modal quality to them, whereas the American fiddle tunes thing, some of the tunes have that quality, but the backup style is very just straight major chords or minor chords.
Totally, yeah, yeah.
And it's a much different rhythmic feel. So as a teenager, I was really into the Irish stuff, and the American Appalachian music in general just sounded a bit, I didn't dislike it, but it sounded a bit rough to me. I liked the singing, I think, but the fiddle tune style, I didn't really understand. Uh-huh. And it was just because from the deep, intense perspective of the Irish fiddle tunes that I was into, the American stuff seemed the tunes just seemed a bit rough and harmonically simple to compare to this more, you know, ornate Irish fiddle zone. And so that was my ears were like very weird because they were just so deep in this particular zone.
Sure.
And so then around age 16, then I did start discovering some of the Alan Lomax field recordings.
Yes.
And some of the, other thing and people from, you know, from those in other corners, like
Do you want to just explain, just for people who might not know, like, yes, who Alan Lomax is and why he might be so important to this folk music thing?
So basically, as you were saying, in the 19th century, early 20th century, this was just music, right? This was just people's music. And there was no technology to preserve it, so they just taught it by ear. That's a whole thing we can get into later. But basically, you know, by the 1920s and 30s, it was starting to no longer become popular music, right? Popular music was jazz and was, you know, what the beginnings of the different forms of, you know, pop music. And so, so at a certain point, the John Lomax, who I think was Alan Lomax's father, and then eventually Alan Lomax, they would go on these trips through the American South. And they would go to Scotland, England, they went all over the place.
Yeah, they went to Ireland, came to Ireland as well.
To Ireland, absolutely. And they made field recordings in people's homes. And there was a particular trip that Alan Lomax made with Shirley Collins, the English folk singer.
Right.
It was this thing called the Southern Journey, I think in 1959, I think. Mm-hmm. And or late 50s anyway, or 60. And they had a really good tape recorder. And the recording quality is so good, and yet they're just in people's houses. It's not a recording studio.
Yeah.
And these recordings really blew my mind and changed my life, because you're just hearing people in their houses, and these people are such beautiful musicians. I'm sure they'd go to the communities and ask, you know, who plays banjo in town. You know, they were the musicians in the community, but they were not professional musicians. Or in their garden, or you can hear the baby crying in the background, you know, and just the whole environment of them was inspiring. And of course, it's not just Alan Lomax. There's a guy called John Cohen. There's many people, you know, who did this. Yeah. And Zora Neale Hurston she's who first brought Alan Lomax to the Georgia Sea Islands. So there's all different connections, and I'm not an expert at all on it.
Wait, so
I'm a musician who loves it.
Sorry, I was just going to say, when you mentioned like the, you know, the baby crying in the background and all the environmental sounds, it makes me think, like, you know, before the advent of recording music, I'm not even so sure how much people would have thought of these sounds as separate from the music. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like maybe once music got recorded and you're trying to isolate just the music as much as you can, then all of a sudden there's this hyper awareness of all other sounds that aren't intentionally the song.
That's a very good point.
And
absolutely.
And then later you get people like John Cage, composers who are like, I want to embrace the environmental sound and let that be heard as music as well. So just the way that recorded music itself has affected how we perceive a song is just so interesting. But yeah, go on with
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so, yeah, no, all of these little places could go off in their own direction. So back to the teenage 16-year-old me ears. The thing that really opened it up was hearing the field recordings, because again, also it was just, often it would just be one person singing, you know, just the intimacy and spareness of it was really beautiful to me.
Yeah.
And I started to, my ears started to understand the subtleties of this music instead of just hearing it as this thing. And and I never became like a deep expert in any of this stuff. I just really loved this, you know, Doc Boggs. I loved Bessie Jones. I loved Elmita Riddle. But I had the background fact that when I would come home, like I go to the CD store to buy Yo La Tengo and Cat Power, and then there, I would see a Doc Boggs CD. I was like, oh, that's weird. They have this here in this store too.
Because
it was all being reissued, and a lot of the kind of hipster type people were getting interested in it. But so the sort of element I had that, you know, was that when I came home, my mom would be like, oh yeah, we have that on record, you know, or they would have, might have seen some of these people perform, like Almeida Riddle, they got to see play. And so, and they themselves sang a lot of the songs. So I'd heard their versions of the songs before the original version,
yeah,
or the previous versions, let's say.
Did it ever occur to you that what your parents were doing at home, or even what you were doing, was the same thing that Alan Lomax had been recording, or did it feel like that was more special somehow because it had already been documented or
no? I definitely. I mean, the community that I think, you know, these different communities of folky type people in the 80s, which is still going now, but you know, going to contra dances, sacred harp sings, all these different things. You know, it was really a way of living the life of this music and bringing it into their lives and having it be as organic in their lives as those people. So I think that was definitely,
you think you appreciated that just as much as a recording of a song?
Definitely.
I only asked that question because I feel like sometimes with technology, my feeling is that we can forget what the point is. Like, okay, the point is to share some music. And so, you might go and put up a song online when really you could play that song yourself or have someone else play it. Like, and that's, in my opinion, going to be a more powerful experience the more direct you can get it.
Absolutely. And I mean, in many ways, I'm like, I've reversed the process because, and so hopefully I haven't entirely, but like, you know, the world that I grew up in was much less about, as you were saying earlier, my world also was much less about being on a stage. And, it was much more about participatory. My parents' whole life has been about participatory music making and not having it be about, you know, them on the stage and more just about them teaching. You know, my parents were singing, leading, folks, you know, social dancing. And so when I was I've arguably reversed that because I am somebody who spends a lot of time on a stage, but you try and get around that as well.
Well, but, I think it all has its place, you know,
of course, yes.
But I, of course, as someone who's been in that role as well on the stage, I can look romantically towards the use of music as just a communal thing.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's beautiful. I think that one thing that I think is cool about my parents in that world was that they weren't fetishistic about the whole field recording thing, right? Because I think we can get a bit attached even to the authenticity of this sort of ancient thing. And they were just like, well, this is, we didn't really listen to that stuff that much on recording when I was a kid because they had learned the song. So once you learned it, you could just sing it yourself. And so that it was less about the kind of going to the, and the most of the records we listened to were made by people in our community, like by people in the folk scene, you know, contra dance band would put out, we'd listen to what they made. So they knew all this stuff from earlier, but again, they were kind of learning it just from a source of learning the songs. Whereas when I discovered it, and they definitely thought of these people as great musicians, but when I started bringing these recordings home, they were like, oh cool, yeah, we love this stuff, we used to listen to this when we were, you know, back then too. And and so I became quite, you know, obsessed just musically with these singers like Doc Boggs, Almeida Riddle, you know, Bessie Jones and stuff. But again, like I never became an expert in it, like I never really learned the deep elements of where, I never really studied it, like it was always just a little bit in the background, and I was more intrigued with it through the people's actual music. I was more like a music nerd in the sense of I loved like Miles Davis and listening to Trump, you know, an instrumentalist and thinking about what they do. And that was probably the same way that I listened to some of these guys. It was less around repertoire at that time. Mm-hmm. It was more about just the sonic thing that's going on in their phrasing and their playing and the rhythm. And that's what
the
I was
character
obsessed with.
As well.
Yes. Of the musician. Mm. And the music itself, and not so when I came, then fast forward like to, you know, to more closer to this time of 2006, 2007, 2008 when I started making those first couple albums of folk songs, you know, the folk songs were still kind of something I didn't really know that well in terms of that world of material. I just understood the music from being around it and playing fiddle near it for so long, so what I'm trying to say is because I spent so much time playing the Irish fiddle tunes, the American stuff was a bit like this other stuff that I would never have claimed to be an expert in or know really well. And I think that helped at that moment when I started singing these songs for the albums, because I didn't really have that many ideas of what were the right way to sing it, or like, cause right. For me to kind of mess around with it, it didn't feel, I was sort of coming from in my mind from outside it.
Yeah. Whereas if you had been entrenched in that world, you might have been stuck in some particular ways these songs should be. Yeah,
totally. And even like in terms of my fiddle playing, part of what I recognized at that age was like, well, I'm just obsessed with Tommy Peoples and Kathleen Collins, and I don't really need to have my own sound on the fiddle. So I just want to play fiddle tunes. So it didn't really feel like a zone almost of, whereas singing and was almost different and stranger because I hadn't really done that.
Right.
So it was a more creative zone because it's that kind of beginner's mind thing where you encounter something and you, oh, I could try this, you know. Mm-hmm. But I had background elements of it here and there, but it was also just this other thing that was, I didn't really have as close a relationship to. And I probably should now learn more. Like I've been listening to, there's Nathan Salzberg who plays really great guitar player, has some very beautiful solo guitar records and plays with Joan Shelley, the singer-songwriter, musician. They're all great. And Nathan works at the Alan Lomax Archive, and he's been doing some incredible podcasts. So like through him and through people I've been learning more in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
There's also a film that's been made by some English filmmakers. Tim Plester and Rob Curry made a documentary about Shirley Collins, which touched on her journey.
I
was able to interview her as part of that, and now they've made another one that is not in wide release yet, which is where they go back to the towns where Alan Lomax made the field recordings and actually interview the people in these towns, you know, about what elements of folk music might still be around, if anybody remembers any of these musicians, how they relate to that music, how politics has entered their lives or not in this current era. So, and it's really beautiful, and I hope it's available for people to see soon. So, but I was like sitting there learning tons in it because I'm not really an expert in that stuff. But again, in that moment with All Is Well and the Chicken album, it was just, it allowed it to just be this kind of odd experiment of taking these stuff.
The Chicken
which
album.
In some ways I knew very well, but yeah.
But this proved false-hearted, right?
Proved. That's right.
Your first album of sing-songs.
Of this, exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, wanted to put that out there for people who might not know what the Chicken album is.
Who aren't intimately aware of every subtle slang term from any album of my discography.
Yeah, yeah. I was just gonna say before that you did put out an album under your own name that it's just solo fiddle, and it is very much this what you were just describing, just straight up playing the tunes. And the second album, But This Chicken Proved False-Hearted, perfect. What you just said makes so much sense if you were to listen to those back to back.
Totally.
So yeah,
absolutely. Because it shows that change, that total change, and how freeing the chicken thing was to go to this other thing that I wasn't. You know, like guitar was quite new for me. Singing on my own was totally new. You know, it was totally new, and I was very shy about it. And then it sort of slowly opened up. But that shyness, I think, was beautiful at that time. It allowed, it, you know, it was very real because I was like encountering something I wasn't sure about. But then I had this sort of background connection to. So the chicken, there's people who would be much better than me at talking about the like ethnographic history of all this music. But what I do love is everything you were describing in your introduction, which is the mystery of it. And the mystery of how these songs came about. I mean, did somebody sit down and write all of Wedding Dress once, and then we just forgot who that person was? Or was it, did somebody write one verse and then the next person, somebody learned the first? They might have only had, because a lot of these songs were like tunes, I think, where somebody might just improvise a little verse on one of them. So maybe somebody had the, you know, sit in like the Saturday night, maybe they only had the Saturday night verse, and then maybe the next person walking home came up with another one.
I did do a little bit of research about this for Wedding Dress, just to see if I could find anything, and I found a very nerdy forum where people were trying to discuss the origins of Wedding Dress, and someone was asking, you know, where does this song come from? Do the different colors have any symbolic meaning? And I've got to show you. I've got to show you this post that I found, because it's quite hilarious, I think. So this person wrote, Jody Stecher recorded it on snake baked a hoe cake. Have you ever heard of that?
I know Jody Stecher was one. I think how my parents learned the song.
Jody Stecher. Jody Stecher recorded it on snake baked a hoe cake. see his note to the song in the reissue, Jody Stecher, Go Up on the Mountain, acoustic.
That's
disc
the one
39.
We knew.
Okay. So,
we did not know Snake Baked a Hoe Cake, but I wish I'd had that one.
So, Stecher had the song from Holly Tannen, who had learned it from Peggy Seeger. After hearing Stecher sing it, a woman at one of his gigs in Scotland expounded to him on the political symbolism of the colors. Accordingly, Stecher later asked Seeger, "So what's the deal with the colors?" "Oh," she said with a big smile, "I only had one verse or two, so I picked some more colors and made up something to rhyme.
No way.
As Stecher says, bing, the sound of truth.
Wow.
So
you just blew my mind.
That's just on the forum.
So possibly Peggy Seeger made up a few of those verses.
Yeah. Should we listen to her version of the tune?
Yes, let's hear it.
Let's hear it. One sec. I'm going to get on this real quick. I pulled up some different versions here in case we want to check any out.
But yeah,
let's give Peggy Seeger a moment here.
Thank you.
There we go.
Wow. That's killing.
Have you heard that before?
Never heard that before.
Wow.
That's so good. Yeah. Also, I can't figure out if it's two banjos or one because there's some sort of higher banjo part that's coming in. That's amazing.
Yeah,
I'm very intrigued as to whether she wrote a couple of those verses or not. Because I've heard that from other. That's a classic thing.
Absolutely, and it cracks me up to think of like people sort of projecting meaning onto something that wasn't intended to have a meaning, but
like the idea of all the colors.
But like also. How real someone can make that, you know, and then you might project that meaning onto it and then make a version of that song and claim it as this song that has this meaning when originally it wasn't intended to at all, but it doesn't take away from the fact that you see it that way, you know,
especially with traditional songs where there's no original law, you know, it's much more mysterious. And I think about that all the time. And for me, that element of sort of accident and openness that you just said is so one of my favorite things about traditional music and the mysteries that they're in. Like there's a song and you know, that whole thing of, again, like somebody might learn the song at the pub and they walk home and they might forget the third verse, which has like a crucial plot detail. Right. So all of a sudden, the song, when they re-sing it, they might either they leave that verse out so it becomes this beautiful ambiguity, or they add another verse in and it changes the lyric entirely. And there's sometimes when there's a one, you know, I sing a song called Pretty Fair Damsel, which is on I See the Sign. Mm-hmm. And it's this wonderful, mysterious story where her woman's husband's going to war on this because he's being flirted with, and she's saying, it doesn't matter even if he's dead, you know, he's the one I love. And I learned it and loved it and recorded it. And then later I heard a version where the guy who's been flirting with her turns out to be the husband in disguise. And it's just like a fidelity test. Which I found way less interesting. And I to this day, I think possibly that just the MP3 copy I had of the version I learned it from just cut off a verse too soon. Like I think even the singer I learned it from might have sung that last verse, but it was just so much for me, just so much more beautiful and compelling without that. To me, the twist at the end just sort of made it really boring. Whereas all the ambiguities of what's going on earlier were like way better.
That's great. And like, you know, in the early days of MP3s and music circulating in that way, it was,
yes,
pretty harsh, you know. Sometimes you'd get a file that's so compressed that it sounds like it's been put through like some sort of 8-bit compressor or something, you know.
Completely.
But yeah, and in that Peggy Seeger song, I was just noticing that it sounded to me like, I might be wrong, but it sounded like she said, "Oh, you little lonely gal, making your wedding dress." And then in the Bob Gibson song, he says, "Lula gal."
Lula, yeah.
And also, when I was trying to look up Lula Gal as a song, I came across another song that Peggy Seeger does called Lula Gal. That's a completely different song. So it makes me wonder if Bob Gibson might have heard both. And then
Maybe it was his mashup. Yeah.
Just not even consciously, but like that's how he remembered it, you know.
Absolutely.
So how did you first hear that song? And what made you want to play it?
So that's a song definitely that my parents loved to sing.
Okay.
And they definitely would have learned it through a similar, I think they learned it off the Jody Stecker that you mentioned there. And he was in the world, and they would have probably known the Peggy Seeger recording as well. Mm-hmm. But I think the Jody Stecker was the one they probably learned it off of.
Okay.
And so I definitely just knew it as a song of, and it's a well-known in, you know, in the folk music scene, it's a fairly well-known song, or by then. And I would have, I remember being hesitant to record it because I felt like it was too kind of just not to record it, but like to have it in my repertoire. Because I think I was trying on my earlier albums to find stranger and more obscure stuff, you know, corners of things that people wouldn't have any association with. And by now I've done quite a few of my parents' repertoire songs, but probably then I was trying to also not dig in too deep to their like things that they sang a lot and just find, I did do songs they sang, but if I would, it would be kind of weird stuff they weren't singing as frequently or whatever. So I was probably more in search of kind of what I thought of as the stranger, more distant corners of things that I could, you know, have my own connection to. And I actually very vividly remember just now as we're talking how I when I first sort of came up with it, which was I was in the moment of revelation. I was in my parents' house. I was downstairs. There was a guitar out. And I know that I was playing really quietly out of necessity. So either it was 2 a.m. and they were asleep, or maybe it was in the afternoon and somebody was taking a nap or something. Because usually in my parents' house, like growing up, it was just cacophony. It was just like everybody playing, you know, it's just like insane. And to this day, I'm amazed at their willingness. Like I would have come back with like Tony Conrad, Drone Minimalism, and Albert Eiler, and been playing it at just like full volume at 11 p.m. But this is a little bit later when I was back, like after college, I was in my, you know, mid 20s or whatever. So I was back visiting the house. Things were probably a bit quieter overall. And I was playing very quietly. And I know that I think I have my guitar here. I was just playing just like a G chord, you know, really, but I had to play really quietly. And I just had that like kind of G chord with it. And I just had that going. And I was practicing my strumming probably, like, you know, the sort of back and forth strumming. And I just did that, but I had to do it really quietly because somebody was asleep. And I started to sing the wedding dress melody was in my head for whatever reason, or it seemed to fit over that, and I sing it. But the thing is, again, I was doubly hesitant about this one because the original wedding dress, if I pull up my second aid, which is the banjo, the original wedding dress, as we've heard in both versions you've played, is modal. So it's not just a straight major chord.
Right, right.
Actually, I think it's actually minor, but it doesn't really sound minor. It sounds kind of, it has that real old time.
Yes, yes.
Like. It's not quite minor, but it has the minor seventh. Oh, my darling little gal, don't you guess, better be making your wedding dress. Wedding dress, wedding dress, better be making your wedding dress. And the thing is that for me, historically, like one of the things about the folk music in the 50s and stuff, like that early, like the Weavers in that early moment, a lot of what I disliked about that music when I was younger was that it felt like it was taking this whole beautiful, weird, dark world of American Appalachian of American folk music, and sort of turning it into this kind of happy, sweet thing, right?
Right.
And that folk music is not happy. Folk music is folk music is dark and strange and mysterious. Yeah, yeah. And so I was doubly hesitant around Wedding Dress because in order for it to fit over that guitar part I was just playing, I had to turn it into just a major song. I had to make the melody major. So the original melody is da 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 da, and I changed it to.
Right. Yeah, very different. Very different.
So I took the minor and the modal out, and I just made it open so that it could go over this major under thing. And I was ambivalent about it because again it was like the wrong direction from what I was intrigued with about all this music. And but again, it just kind of wanted to be there and felt good. And in a way, I think that is something I've done in both directions with some of these folk songs, which is, you know, there's that hilarious thing about with a lot of the folk music, which is it'll be like a lot of traditional folk songs are like the happiest melody. Like you listen just to the music and it sounds so happy. And then it's like 10 verses about murder and destruction.
Yes,
and
absolutely. So, you know,
sometimes, which itself is also really deep and cool. Uh-huh. I love that. But it's allowed for there to be some room on my albums with something like, Rain and Snow or something where, you know, I've taken it and tried to give it a musical environment that matches this meaning, even though I love that quality of how the meaning, the music is going against the meaning.
Yeah.
Just, so, yeah. So again, it was sort of here, it was the same thing. It was sort of like in reverse, where it was just giving it this beautiful, happy thing, which then, of course, the song is actually, you know, the song is quite ambiguous, right? Because she's just...
What's she doing? She's making a wedding dress, but
she's stalling.
She won't say yes and she won't say no. And
yeah, it's like Scheherazade. She's stalling.
She's going to keep trying out different colors and...
Exactly.
So she's frustrating. No.
Exactly. No, it is. No, it is. I think it's ambiguous.
It is ambiguous, but there's a beauty in that as well, somehow. Like sort of getting into the process of making the wedding dress without being too concerned, actually, of when or how is it going to be used. How about just the actual process of the joy of making the dress?
Absolutely. Yeah. But at the same time, absolutely, it's that. And I think, but it's also sort of, I love that it's just the ambiguity of what's in her heart and in her mind, you know, it's sort of circling around that in a very cool way. And so yeah, I it was one that I was ambivalent about because it just felt sort of too simple or something, but then, you know, those are beautiful things sometimes. But yeah, I think it allowed a little bit for the kind of potentially mournful quality of what's going on. And yet it's also a very sweet, beautiful song about a wedding dress.
Yeah. And so that album, All Is Well, featuring your recording of Wedding Dress, one of the things that like now I would come to your music nowadays, I'm very much, it's kind of only in the last few years that I've really become more interested in this folk tradition. I think it's actually since moving to Ireland and being surrounded by a bit more living folk tradition.
Yes.
But at that time in 2008, one of the ways that pulled me into that record is that record in particular features these very decorative arrangements by, is it Nico Muhly or Muhly? Nico Muhly. And because at that time I was, you know, I was into folk music and stuff, but I was also, and still am, very much into composition and classical-ish jazz, you know, just, you know, instruments, symphonic kind of stuff. And I was blown away by the combination of folk songs and these sort of arrangements. And that was
orchestrations.
Kind of something, one of the things that drew me in. So I wonder if you might, I'd be curious just to know how that all played out for you. At what point did that come in as an element, and how did that all feel and work out?
No, that was a beautiful time for, and it was very, very spontaneous and kind of came out of nowhere almost. It was amazing. So I had made the first album, the Chicken album, But This Chicken Proved Toss-Hearted with Thomas, which was that first zone of discovery around the whole idea of, you know, messing around with, you know, reworking the folk songs and using that as a platform for collaboration and sonic exploration, you know. And but it was all very new and very tentative still, and it wasn't like I was like if you'd met me, I wouldn't have been like, oh yeah, I'm a singer. I would have just been like, yeah, I'm a fiddle player. Like, it was still something I was just doing as this sort of, you know, to try something out and to slowly start singing again. And Nico was friends with Thomas and then friends with me as well, and he, you know, was with all his incredible, beautiful, dazzling, you know, stuff he was doing and his whole verbal style,
dazzling,
and everything about Nico. And so Thomas and I, or Thomas gave him I think it was about 2 years between finishing the Chicken album and it getting released. So for a long time, it was just something I had on CDR that I was giving around to people. And I was playing banjo in Thomas's indie rock band Dove Man, and so I would just give that around to people at, you know, different, and Thomas was sharing it to friends as well. So Nico brought it to Iceland.
Okay.
And he was working with Valgeir, and they were doing some work with Björk on Medulla, but at the same time Valgeir was sort of
Sigurdsson.
Thank you. Yes, the great Valgeir Sigurdsson, and who he had worked very closely with Björk on Dancer in the Dark and Medulla, and he'd done some stuff on and Vespertine as well, but he was beginning to kind of strike out on his own, and he and Nico had this idea of starting a label that, and they had built this, he had built this beautiful recording studio, Greenhouse Studios in Reykjavik.
Yes.
And Valgeir, Ben Frost, and Nico, you know, met, and Nico just was, you know, fell in love with Iceland and started learning Icelandic and going there as much as possible. And he and Valgeir just made this really strong connection. And they had this idea of starting the label, Bedroom Community. And the first three artists were Ben and Valgeir and Nico to have the idea. And then Nico got really excited. Nico brought the Chicken album to Valgeir. I think what you were saying, like, I think at that time, like, in this sort of in broader indie world, the folk music thing wasn't as present at that time yet. So I think they were kind of just like, what even is this folks, you know? And
right.
So they were intrigued by my music, and basically Nico brought me to Airwaves Festival in Iceland in this fall of 2006. And we went officially to play there. And for Nico had the idea by then of The Only Tune. So The Only Tune is this 15 minute long, crazy deconstruction piece by Nico that's written for me that we kind of developed together.
Came out on one of his albums, Mother Tongue. Yes.
Yes. And it ended up coming out after all as well, but we actually recorded it first.
Okay.
And so he officially brought me to record that piece. And which was kind of like us doing what we do on All's Well, but on his turf, and as opposed to on my turf, like All's Well is my turf and his own. They're very, you know, it's very similar. And so he brought me there, and we went there for like 4 days. On one day we recorded all my parts, which just literally came out of Nico's head. He was like, try this for The Only Tune. And then the next day we had the festival concert, and it was sort of, you know, me just being my mind blown, going to Iceland for the first time, meeting all these wonderful people. And then Valgeir and I had sort of, I think at one point he had considered putting up, anyway, we sort of talked about stuff. We had the idea of doing something together. I didn't really know what any of these people did. I just thought it was like Icelandic and maybe electronic or something. Uh-huh. And so late at night on the last night, like at 11 p.m., Valgeir and I were like, he's like, do you have some songs? Like, I had gotten a few songs together. And we went up in the upstairs in the studio, and I just put down like basically almost all the basic tracks that then for All As Well right then. It was very beautiful drinking whiskey. Valgeir was like lying on the floor with his eyes closed. And again, I was very shy. Like I was like, can I even play like all the way through a song on guitar? It was all so new still.
Wow.
And I would often leave a lot of space at the end, like in case they needed to edit stuff in, which most of the time is still just on the album, and it just became a zone for the Nico. I think we didn't really know. There was no discussion of what was going to happen, or it was very much just the three of us, Valgeir, Nico, and I, just coming together with we didn't know each other very well. We had this, you know, it was just a beautiful, and it was new for everybody, I think, you know, sort of, you know, I don't think Nico had done too much arrangements on people's records yet. Everything was new for all of us, this encounter. And then basically, so they were just solo tracks. And then Valgeir's idea was for me to take them back to New York and for him to keep them with Nico there. And for nobody to hear what anybody else was doing.
So
I went back to New York and I added some electric guitar and some fiddle and had Avan Kang play some viola and had my brother Stefan play some drums and Aaron Siegel do some percussion. But they were just added to my solo track. And then literally Nico was like, hey, I went to Iceland and added a bunch of stuff to your shit. And last weekend, I was like, oh, cool. And then I came and it was like, Mark Hollis album all of a sudden, you know, there's like incredible, there's ton, you know, all over beautiful, like mad completely. So I went with, I was like, you know, my mind was totally blown. I was like, oh, here it is.
So wait,
and
you
literally
felt
no discussion.
You had a positive experience first hearing those arrangements.
Absolutely, man. My mind was blown.
Yeah. Okay.
But I had added all these. What the hell is this shit?
Well, because some people, I've had experiences where I might be recording somebody, and sometimes it's great. I work on something and I send it to them, and they're like, "Wow, this is so cool." And sometimes you might work on something as an arranger, and they're like,
"Yeah,
get totally. your ego off of my song.
Yeah. No, I think it was just all so mad and new and great. Yeah, it was totally not what I expected to do there. Not that I really knew what I expected to do there. But definitely, like, I had then there was like a week where Valgeir and I went through everything because, you know, we had to make this all sound like, to bring things together, you know. And I mean, the Nico's arrangements are the primary element, but there are some subtle stuff in terms of little electric guitar parts I'd put in, or mm-hmm. some percussion here, you know, things like that, so we were making a lot of decisions then, and there were, we did trim back some of the arrangements to Nico's chagrin, but not too much, but just here and there, just to, again, there were just ways of folding things in together. And then Valgeir mixed it, after I had left. And he did some beautiful, you know, idiosyncratic stuff in the mixing process as well. Not like in terms of processing, but just in terms of where he plays stuff and putting things into a certain space and everything. So it was really just like, I was talking about it with Glenn Hansard a few months ago, because I saw him and he because he loves that album as well. Uh-huh. And it's just, for him, it's the one. And he was just like, it was love. You can hear it on the album. It was love. And it really was. It was just this really, you know, it was really special. And I think the tentativeness is part of it for me, because it's I'm much more confident now as a singer and player, but I'm sort of glad that I wasn't then, because it just adds to the feeling of the music, I think.
Absolutely. Oh, what a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. that's interesting, because, you know, yeah, of course, once you lose that tentativeness, there's no getting it back. So you have to find it somewhere else. Find something else to be your sort of strength in the music.
Absolutely.
That's so interesting.
It's funny, because for me, like, the songs that I would get more excited about were the ones that I had really done something that I creative in terms of the changing of the song. Mm. Whereas I think to other people that doesn't matter as much, right? So for me, like, I was really more like, to me, things like Sarah, which is another song people really love from that album, like Sarah and Wedding Dress, to me, were like not special to me. Like, I was much more excited about like Prodigal Son, or things where I'd really kind of written more of a part around the thing, or, you know, those were like toss-offs, you know, and yet I think those were just where, you know, the magic, you know, because you don't really know as a musician.
You get
super excited. I'm sure you're familiar with this too, like, you know, but then you make it and then something happens and then you see what people respond to.
That's it. And it just goes to show that, you know, how worthwhile it can be sometimes to have, for an artist, to have sort of other people and filters to put stuff through, because, you know, someone who works at a label, ideally they might have a good vision of what's the first thing to put out that's going to resonate with people and draw them towards this thing. So if you can find that relationship with people you trust, and you trust them to go with their instinct on that, then that's fantastic. Of course, there's also scenarios where an artist feels like they have no creative freedom and someone else is taking the reins, and there's a fine line there. But I was doing a little bit of, I was just looking up to see if I could find your version of Wedding Dress, and I found a very charming music video of Wedding Dress. So do you want to watch that and just have a listen to your version?
Yeah, let's do it.
Those arrangements and
let's do it.
Valgeir's production and all that.
And is this with Sigasuna's puppet animation?
Yes.
Wonderful. It's beautiful. Yes.
Let me just pull it up.
Oh, it's already made, trimmed in. danced all around with a golden thread. Hearts already made, trimmed and brown, dressed all around with a golden.
Beautiful video.
I know. Beautiful.
Wow. Well, Sam, this has been such a great chat. Is there anything else that comes to mind with the song? Are there any other versions that you're aware of?
The only other one that we haven't mentioned yet is Pentangle.
Yes, and
that's which is classic.
I did find that, and maybe we shouldn't listen to the whole thing, but maybe I should play a snippet of it just for people.
Yeah,
so they can get a sense of, you know,
play a snippet,
just how different a song can be.
Because of course, Pentangle is doing all the thing is in England. There's much more of a tradition of like psychedelic renditions of traditional music. I mean, you know what I mean. That whole thing is, and Pentangle is the best version with great Bert Jansch and John Renbourn on guitar.
Let's check this out for a minute. that's
great.
I'm going to stop that there because another version I found, which I'd love to play a little snippet of, is did you know that Frank Zappa did a version of this song?
No way. Yeah.
And I think my suspicion is that he based his version on the Pentangle version.
I bet that makes sense.
It has a kind of jangliness to it. Yeah, just listen to this for a second.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
So, you know, and
that's amazing.
Isn't that great? And, you know, of course, there's no words there as well. It's just an instrumental piece.
Instrumental version.
So,
yeah.
You know, I love that as well, that, you know,
totally.
Is it still the same song? If it's a song with words that conveys
right.
some sort of message, is it still the song when it doesn't have words?
Totally. When it's been turned to that.
That's a good bit of transformation for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, man, thanks. So, you know, I know we've already listened to like four or five different versions of this song, but I thought since you're someone who seems to embrace sort of spontaneous stuff, I made some loopy drony synthesis
Great.
In the key of G. And I wondered if we might do like a
Let's jam it.
Zoom version of Wedding Dress and you know,
I'm ready, Peter.
Stretch the Love boundaries it. Of this song even further, perhaps.
Bring it on.
Let me get it going.
Bring it on. Thank you.
wouldn't say no. All she'd do, just sit and sew. Sit and sew, sit and sew. All she'd do, just sit and sew.
Nice one.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Sam.
Beautiful to speak with you and play with you, Peter.
Yeah. after just asking you to do this song, I remembered that the one time I've played together with you before, we performed this song. And it was when we did a little concert at Serpent Jazz Court. It was only after the fact I realized.
Not too long ago.
We played this song, but my memory of playing that was like trying to keep up. It was not a comfortable feeling performing. So that felt much nicer. So thanks again, and thanks so much, Sam.
Such a pleasure, Peter.
Yeah.